Hello and welcome back to Tech Days Online 2017. One of the problems I see in data science, one of my favourite things, is we've got academia over there, and over there we've got the real world. Actually, at the moment we've got academia over here and we've got the real world over there. So I'm joined by Dr. Bradley Love from University College London and a whole load of other places, including Texas and Boston and...
Yeah, I've been around, but I'm happy to be here, in particular at Microsoft today. Yeah, I'm a professor of cognitive and decision sciences at UCL and a faculty fellow at the Alan Turing Institute for Data Science. My research involves aspects of experimental psychology, neuroscience, and machine learning. And for purposes of today, we're focusing on social sciences. So I want to talk a little bit about how we could use theory from social sciences to inform big data analyses.
Yeah. Yeah. So trying to understand what us humans are up to using big computing and smart people.
Yeah, exactly. And trying to get more out of the data by incorporating some constraints, some more theory from behavioral sciences to make the solutions we come up with a little bit more understandable. You know, open up the black box.
You're not going to frighten us with too many equations, are you?
Oh, I promise there are no... there's one equation, but it's very simple. Yeah, so no need to tune out just yet.
Because I think Stephen Hawking said the number of equations would cut his book sales in half every time he put an equation in, etc.
Well, he knows how to move the book, so I should take that advice.
Right, anyway, sorry.
No. So I was thinking of trying to cover two topics. So one concerns... basically predicting when people are willing to explore new options. So if someone buys a Coke every day at lunch, can we predict when they want to open to trying something new? And it turns out, you know, we can. The second part, I want to talk a little bit about why people perceive certain products to be similar to each other. Like, why is a Coke more like a Pepsi than a bottle of water? And it turns out, using techniques from computational linguistics, we could pull out these sort of similarities that people find just looking at, you know, the purchase patterns. So yeah, I want to focus on that stuff. I know this is Tech Days, but a lot of this talk will be science focused, but along the way I'll try to convey some practical lessons, some problems we came across in these projects that might help out those listening on their own projects, and try to keep it in a fairly general way. So in the first part of the talk involves sequential data, time series, and there I want to talk about how interpretation can go awry and the importance of doing permutation tests, which there won't be equations, but I'll just give the basic concepts so people could chase up that are interested in that. In the second part of the talk, I'll talk about some of the dangers of just applying a package, you know, from some popular machine learning library, and how just some checks you want to do to make sure your solution actually makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, right, well, let's do this.
All right, great. Okay, so, in the last 10 years, you know, there's been amazing progress in machine learning research, and a lot of it actually has been taking these more black box approaches that I'm going to contrast with what I'm going to be up to today. So, for example, maybe you've come across these deep convolution neural networks that are the state of the art in object recognition, and these models are the ultimate black box. They contain millions of parameters or weights. They work very well, but it's not always clear why. They're trained, all these weights are trained on just tons of labeled images. Mm-hmm. So if you feed these models images of cars, people, and they're labeled, and then they'll actually generalize to novel ones, which is great, but it's not always clear why. And let me show you an example. So I don't know, Andrew, if you could tell me what this is, this object.
I think it's a way of sending our audience to sleep.
It looks like we've gone. I think we did send somebody to sleep.
Yeah, we sent the machine to sleep.
Okay. Well, anyway, I think that image. To us, so looks like
a penguin.
Is it? Yeah, nothing. Well, yeah. I mean, I think you're seeing the next slide.
I am. I'm cheating. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. But this looks like much of nothing. But yeah. To the deep convolutional network, this is the 100% confidence example of a penguin, okay?
And I can kind of see what's going on here. Yellow bands and those yeah. stripes going down are almost the same profile as
yeah.
a penguin.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's some key, like, texture elements or color, you know, features yeah. that it's picking up on. So it's clearly not seeing the images like we are, you know?
Yeah.
And this could lead to the spoofing, you know? So there's some practical... So this is an actor, Emil Yovovich, but according to the state of the art, image face recognition system. This is also her, and it doesn't really look very much like her to me. So there again, there's just some key texture elements that the model's using, and those are basically been pasted onto this fella's spectacles, and so that's so enough to spoof the system.
So if I take these off, I'm going to look more like you or less like you?
Mila? Yeah. Luckily, I'm running human hardware software. But I guess the point, so you could imagine some real-world consequences to not understanding how your machine systems, learning systems are working. So what I want to advocate here today is, we're never going to get rid of the black box approaches, but it'd be nice if in cases we could adopt a simpler model and take a more of a theory-driven approach. So today, the topic's in social science, so I want to talk about taking theories from experimental psychology and decision-making and how people detect similarities and use them really as a lens to guide the analysis process, rather than having millions of tunable parameters, and see if we can get some results. So we want to open up the black box, and hopefully what's inside is pretty like this kitty, but even if it's ugly and fearsome, at least we'll know what we're dealing with.
Yeah. I guess if you're going to make a really, really big decision, being able to sort of audit the way that you got there is going to be important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I think that'll be increasingly important when we rely on machines to make, important decisions, not just labeling our, images and our photo libraries. But even there, some of the mistakes can be potentially inflammatory to people. If the listeners Google or Bing,
it's okay.
Or use a favorite to look up. Yeah, there's been cases where people's photos have really got inappropriate and hurtful labels. So even in seem the most innocuous applications, it would be good to know how these things are working.
But if we were doing image analysis in a medical environment, that would be super, super important.
Yeah, and legally important to have these. Yeah, so. So we're just going to keep things simple and take some theory from social science, which you might not think of offhand as like being able to guide an analysis. Mm-hmm. So now I just maybe step back and go through a little bit of science about how people explore. So the majority of work in labs involves what I'd call objective rewards. So things like money or points. So people try to make the right responses and they're rewarded for it. And it's no one has to tell you that 20 pounds is better than 10 pounds. But when you move into the real world, it's not so clear with subjective rewards. So who's going to say if this pizza is better than this one, right? It becomes more subjective. And so we want to look at how people explore in those circumstances. So here's like a really brief definition of exploration. So it's seeking a goal under uncertainty, and there's trade-offs. So basically, you could exploit known opportunities, like always go to your favorite restaurant. But if you don't explore, you'll never find something better. But every time you explore, you're foregoing the opportunity to have, your favorite. So there's this tension between the two things. And this is something any intelligent system faces, whether it's, a robot, a person, or certainly animals, So, whoops. I think we've lost.
Just try and touch that. Do you think that's going to work?
I guess give it one.
We've lost the video here.
There we go. Okay, so these fellas are going supermarket shopping. We're going to be looking at people going shopping in Tesco, but here they're going shopping for termites. Yeah, and so if the ape finds a good hole with lots of termites in it and sticks with it, that's exploiting. But of course, to find a better one, better location, you need to explore, try something new, or maybe your current location becomes depleted. So there's always this tension between exploring and exploiting, and maybe here's a more human example. So if you're commuting to work, you have a choice of two routes. If you always stick with your preferred one, you'll never discover a better one, right? So there's this issue you need to explore enough, but there's also a key issue you want to focus on here is when do you explore. So just to give you an example, imagine yesterday you took an alternative route to the office. And it was horrible. There were road works. It was very slow. You wouldn't try that same explore that same route the next day, right? Because you have very low uncertainty. You know the route, the road works are not going to complete. It's probably still going to be an inferior route. But maybe in 4 months, it will have improved. And so you'll have higher uncertainty about it, and you'll explore. So basically, we look at models that describe how people should explore ideally. So these are simple not simpler, but partially observable Markov decision processes are related to dynamic programming. They basically figure out, you know, when you should explore, and they're complicated, but what they basically say is that you should explore when you're uncertain, which makes sense. Like, why explore when you're pretty sure you have the best thing already? And so we look at whether people do this in the lab, in a task where there's two options, like those two roads, and one could leapfrog over the other and improve. And so, you know, you want to stick with the best option to be rewarded the most, but you need to explore. You won't discover that the other option might have improved, like the one road might have improved over the other. And so we want to look whether people show this pattern of exploration here that the ideal model does, where the longer you've been exploiting, so the more you've been sticking with your preferred option, the more kind of curious you should become about the other option as you're uncertain about it. So you want to see if people show this. And surprisingly, you know, psychologists in an experimental psychology department always show you examples where people do the stupid thing. Here's a case where people do the smart thing. They actually do explore more the longer they've been exploiting. But this is, again, with objective rewards. Like, what do people do in the real world? Can we predict when people want to explore, say, new products, when you're willing to try something new? And we're going to look in a supermarket context using a big data analysis with Tesco. So this work was done jointly between UCL Dunnhumby, which is a consumer data science company, and Tesco using their loyalty card data. So if you've ever shopped in Tesco, you might have been in the study. It's like, yes. If people get curious about what I talk, I want to hear more. There's a very brief paper in the inaugural issue of Nature Human Behavior and a podcast and some popular press. Okay, so we pretty much have a handle on how people explore on these constrained tasks with objective rewards like money, points, almost like a game-like task that we could do in the lab. But what goes on in the real world when things are more complex and they unfold over days and when things are subjective? I mean, I think this is really the key. So for decisions people make, we had this idea that we're, you know, kind of rational, but maybe this isn't true. You know, so like we think of our choices following our preferences, so we choose what we prefer. But maybe it could be the other way around at times. Maybe what we choose, we just come to prefer. You know, so I say this because when we consume things, it's very subjective. So again, like what makes one, you know, brand of food better than another? There's so many dimensions to the quality, the flavor, whether it's healthy or not. And how we weight those is fairly subjective, but also each of those factors themselves, like taste, is subjective itself. So it might very well be, you know, if someone drives a BMW, they become a BMW person, or if they use, maybe, hopefully we use a Microsoft product, become a Microsoft person.
We'd like to think so.
Yeah, but there might be a bit of like
But just, you find some people never use a particular thing, or they'll always use a different thing, you know, and you almost get that. You could put a sticker on this machine, and some people are always going to buy it, and some people are always going to avoid it. Whereas what we're hoping is that they'll at least try it out.
Yeah, yeah. So what we're going to be doing an analysis of is like when are people willing to try it out, but it could well be that you see this exact opposite pattern of where what you choose you actually come to prefer. And this sounds crazy, but there's this phenomena referred to as choice blindness, in which people are very unaware of choices they just made. And if you reverse the choice, you present them with something they didn't actually choose and say, oh, you chose this, not only will they not be aware of it, but they'll go on to justify it. So I just want to show a really brief video of this. This is, let's see if we get this to play.
We actually get to do a lot there.
Okay, great. So this woman in black is an experimenter unknown to this person. And this woman in white is tasting these two jams. But notice these are double-ended containers.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When she tastes it, it's being turned over. So each one of these containers contains both varieties of jam. And so now the woman in white, notice it goes upside down, is being asked, which do you prefer? And she's saying, well, I have a very sophisticated palate. So I prefer, you know, the first option. Now she's going to go on to detail more why. But she's actually tasting the other one, the one that was in the blue container she tasted before, because these are double-sided containers, completely unaware and going on and on about it. So it's only one more step from this to whatever ends up in your basket in the supermarket you just come to like. So that implies a very different pattern of exploration. And then we could test. These are things you really couldn't test in the lab. But, you know, we could take a big data approach. This is what we're going to do. We're just going to look at people's shopping patterns. And if people treat products in the world like information, they should show this pattern where the longer they've been exploiting, so shown in blue, the more likely they should be to explore. So it's almost like they get curious about the alternatives. Mm. This is what we see in the lab, and this is what you should do from like a machine learning perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you were building a robot, you'd probably want to do this. But if instead people are doing this, we call coherency maximization, where your preferences come to follow your choices, you should see this exact opposite sawtooth pattern, mm-hmm. where the more you exploit, the more you choose your favorite, the more likely you are to keep doing it until you kind of pop out of this entrainment, and then all bets are off, and it like restarts this process. Mm-hmm. So importantly, I'm not saying here that people just choose something and stick with it forever. It's just that we're just trying to predict when will people switch. And so we want to contrast these two views by looking at a few hundred thousand shoppers over 5 years in the UK. So here's our big data over a variety of products. Okay, and so we get data like a sequence of for individual sequence of purchases for some product class. Like here's just detergent, and we just code it whether they've repeated their previous purchase or not. And so we just call repeats exploits and no repeats explorers. You could have more sophisticated codings. There's so much data, it ends up. Which is nice, and it's not mattering too much.
Yeah. Really simple buckets, even though they're buying different things. Yeah. Different choices,
Yeah, exactly. So we're just basically looking at the patterns of explore and exploit. So here's just a big overview of if you look at the first 2.5 years of an individual's data versus the last 2.5 years over these hundreds of thousands of people, interestingly, it's not like they just settle into what their preferred thing is. They're always exploring. So this is showing the rate of exploration, and it's fairly stable over this 5 years. So the first 2.5 years, they're exploring overall as much as the last 2.5. But here's like the key thing, and we'll expand it out, is that this is looking at whether when do people explore? Do they explore when they're on these short streaks or on these long streaks? And it's exact opposite of what you see in the lab. So the more someone's been exploiting, sticking with their favorite, the less likely they are to explore. So rather than like what we see like in the lab up top, we don't see that. We see more of this strange pattern where it looks like people's preferences are following their choices. So this is kind of interesting. This is exactly opposite of what you'd expect if people are treating products as information. Some really basic models to make sense of this, and I don't think this qualifies as an equation.
No.
Good.
It's got no Greek in it.
No Greek. Yeah, great. Even for the Leighton Dirichlet allocation later, there will be no Greek. So basically, we want to just see if people have this tendency. This is just a little simple logistic regression model. And the question is the slope negative, which means people are doing this coherency maximization, meaning they're less likely to explore the more they've been exploiting? Or are they doing kind of what we saw in the lab, this more upward trend where you get kind of curious about the products? And so we just fit this model to each individual's data. And here's just a plot of all the people in black there. And you can see that most people have this negative slope. So most people are consistent with this coherency maximization, this sort of idea you just fall in love with what you buy until you don't, and then you pop out of an explorer. I'll get to what those gray bars in a second, because it's kind of important for making sense of this sequential data. But basically, it's a kind of control analysis. But the key here is, and we'll get to it, because I think there's a fairly general point for others working with sequential data that you would want to do it.
Yeah.
But let me just spell it out. A couple other things about how this could affect behavior. So you want to look at coupon use. Does it also kind of follow from these ideas of expiration? And it does. So if someone's in a long exploitation streak on like the top bar there, and they're in love with their product, they're going to be slower to redeem a coupon. It's going to take them more days for some novel product. And you see the exact opposite pattern. If you give somebody a coupon for their favorite thing, the longer they've been exploiting it, the more important, the more they'll prioritize it. Being good scientists, we did a quick follow-up study, because this is all using existing data. We actually ran our own study where we sent people coupons out and looked at the redemption rate, and you see the same interactions. So you could almost double the rate people redeem these coupons. If they're on a long exploitation streak and you send them a coupon for something, you know, that's novel and green, you know, they're not much interested in it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if they're on the exploitation streak, they're very interested in it. So so you could, you know, basically hopefully less junk mail.
But you put some science into this. You looked at the historical data, which could have some noise in it, and you did a controlled experiment.
Yeah, so this is like a really good, important point. So there are things, obviously a lot of, like, if you're working on an application, and you obviously, a lot of people won't have this opportunity to collect new data, but fortunately we had the opportunity to do the proper science here, where we made sense of the old data and then tried to go through and get a new sample to see, make sure these ideas held. What we also did, which you know, maybe some of the listeners can do that don't have the opportunity to collect new data, is we used just basic cross-validation approaches too with the old data. So, you know, we'd fit the model to a subset of the data, say the first 4 years of an individual's purchase patterns, and then just see what happens without changing any of the parameters for that final year. And so that works too, and that's really key, because even if you're using model selection statistics or using a fairly simple model, you could still fool yourself. So it's important to do what machine learning people call this out-of-sample predictions. This is something, you know, anybody could do. So if you have your application and you're fitting some kind of, you know, even just regression model like here, a more complex machine learning model, you want to do this kind of, you know, out-of-sample prediction just to, as a sanity check, you know, and it's not too hard to do.
It's going to take a different set to do our testing and scoring.
Yeah.
Again, and some of the tools you can fold the data over. So you take your 20% testing set and then you've got 80% for training.
Yeah.
You then run it again, but use a different random 20%.
Yeah, exactly. So you could have what people refer to as multiple folds.
Yeah.
So, because I guess maybe this is getting too mathematical, but if you just split the data in half and train on half, test on half, in essence, you're throwing away half the data because you're going to bias towards simpler models because more complex models like more data. You know, so like at the beginning of this talk, speaking about these vision models, these deep convolutional neural networks, they need a ton of data, so you wouldn't want to just throw away half the training data. So you could do exactly what you were saying. You could train on, you know, 80% and then do a validation and test on the remaining, and then just swap them all around, you know, the different folds, so you could have the best of both worlds.
Make sure the scores are going really high and we're not overfitting, I think, is the
Yeah. I've got a little figure on that later. But overfitting is this phenomenon where you have a more complex model, it'll always do better in the data you could see, but there comes a point where it'll start doing worse on the data you can't see, you know? It's sort of like what would it be? I don't want to say like a fortune teller, but somebody, you know, could tell a really good story, but,
we could look at what Rooney had for breakfast over the last 5 weeks and make a prediction about how his team will perform on the weekend.
Right, and then, exactly, some spurious correlation. Yeah, and maybe it works once, but yeah. So in this part of the talk, you know, we really used this lens on the big data. It's something very simple, but something the retailer never really got onto. You know, it was just really looking at how humans explore and ways in which they might not do it exactly how you thought. And we were able to just discern between these two views. And people did this more what we call coherency maximizing. They tried to make their choices and preferences align. And so it seems a bit irrational, but it's what people do. So the more they've been exploiting an option, the less likely they are to explore. But once they explore, they reset, okay? And in terms of prediction, I didn't go into this, but it's almost like a personality trait how people explore things. So if somebody shows this pattern of exploration for, say, beer, they'll also show it for detergent. You know, like they show it across product classes. So if they do, you know, there are some people that do explore the opposite way with uncertainty minimization. And those people, again, they'll do it across everything. So it's almost like you could predict from one product how people will explore in another one, which is kind of interesting. So I guess you want to use this for good or for evil, you probably can. So if you want to change someone's behavior, maybe one, or your own behavior, I mean, one suggestion would be to hit people at a period of exploration. So what we've seen here is people become less and less open to offers, to coupons, or changing what they do the more they're on an exploitation streak. Yeah. But once they try anything new, it then sort of all bets are off. Then it's very like they're very susceptible to being, you know, their choice being influenced. So you could imagine this also as your New Year's resolution goes off the rails or something. Be careful.
But what you're saying is if I change my choice of red wine that I buy, I might at the same time be also influencing my choice of pizza. Because I'm going to try experimentation generally.
Yeah, well, you know, so that's a really fascinating idea. So we're trying to get actually a handle on that in the data now. So we don't actually know.
That's, oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, so you're, that's really, really stupid. But what we did find is that if for one product, so you're basically saying, you know, things might be time locked so that you go through these general periods of expiration in your life. And we're looking to that now. But what we do have the data on is just for the individual products, if you show this pattern of the more you buy this thing, the more you're going to stick with it until you don't, you know, basically until you pop out of this sort of downward slope. If you show that for, say, beer, you'll show that same pattern for your detergent purchases.
Okay.
You know, so whether they're time linked or not, don't know. They might be, might not be, because all these products, some things you can buy every day, some things you buy once a month, so who knows? Yeah. So one thing that came up in this that might be a quick methods point that could apply more generally, not just to any kind of sequential data, time series type analysis that people might be doing, is there's some odd things going on with sequential data, and we actually at times we've got results that perplex us until we got a handle on it. So I don't know, just to make an analogy about another kind of sequential data is if people are familiar with this idea of a hot hand when an athlete is performing at a high level, you know, they like feed them the ball, they're golden right now, they can do no wrong. So athletes definitely believe this. It's even, I found this old video game that, let's see if I could get this to play. So here, in this game, when a player makes a bunch of shots in a row, they their hand is so hot, it literally sets the ball on fire. So clearly the hot hand must be true, right? It's in video games. But there's annoying psychologists decades ago pointed out that if you look, do the statistical analysis, and this is where the being careful about sequential data comes in, the probability of making a shot in a professional basketball game following a success or a failure, a miss, is the same. So you'd think that doesn't mean there's a hot hand, but beware in sequential data. Some economists have more recently suggested that's not the proper way to analyze sequential data, and this is something actually came up in ours. So I just want to share it very briefly with listeners. So let's even make it simpler than just making basketball shots.
Yep.
Something you can't bring in any sort of background knowledge, you know, all the defense is changing for the basketball the players or whatnot. A coin, heads or tails, it's 50% chance of each, right? So what about if we make it a little bit more of a sequential question? What's the probability of a head given a head on the previous flip? Now, everyone will say, well, it's 50%. The coin doesn't have a memory. This is just basic probability. Why is this professor asking me such ridiculous questions? Well, it turns out it's actually a bit more complicated than that. And this ends up coming out in sequential data analyses. So yes, if you only flip the coin once or an infinite times, it is 50%. But let's imagine we just look at a sequence like you might have in real data of just three flips. So with three flips, there's eight different possibilities.
Yep.
You could have all tails, all heads. And if we wanted this question of the probability of a head falling ahead, then these are sort of the interesting points that I've underlined there. Obviously, if you have a head on the last flip, you can't have a head on the next one. So if you go through the key events where you could measure this, and you just look at the probability of success or failure, so in the third row, there's tails, heads, tails, and so that's a failure. And so the probability of success if you have that event is zero. On the last trial, there's two events, and they're both successes. And if you go across the six events that are all equally likely, and you just plot this, so some events have zero chance of success, of a head falling ahead, some have half, some have one, they're all equally likely, and you just do the math. It turns out with a limited sequence of three, the probability of a head falling ahead is not 50%, it's actually less, it's 5/12. So that means in these original hot hand studies, if the probability of making a basket following a successful one is equal to failing, well, maybe they actually have a hot hand. So it's like there's all these biases in sequential analyses, and I'm sure some people are saying this isn't true. If you have time, you could go through this simple example in the math, or, you know, if you really don't trust it, just get a coin and start flipping it three times or thousands of times. But trust me, it's actually 5/12.
I'm sure you're right. I mean, I kind of get this prior probability thing. When you start studying probability, I think the first thing you realize is that what you thought was true.
Yeah.
Isn't quite as true as you thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What's going on here, just maybe intuitively, is that there's events, these six events that are relevant for calculating this probability are concentrated in a couple items, and that's sort of creating this downward bias. And it happens in any time you have a limited sample of data, which we always do. We deal with data. So we could see this in our own data. So this is why I just want to make a little pitch. If you're dealing with data, to don't trust yourself. Do like some kind of what I call a permutation analysis. So in this, so here are the model fits for the explore exploit stuff. And black was the analysis of the real data. In gray, what we did is we shuffled the order of people's purchases randomly and then refit the model. And so you can see here, you'd think it would be centered at zero slope, right? If it was just random, but there's actually the same skew you'd expect from what I just showed you with the coin flips towards these positive slopes. And so the key thing for us, so we actually underestimated our effects by, if we just, by just the black bars, if you can, because there's actually the whole distribution, there's a bias to shift everything upward, you know? So we had, this actually led to some spurious results early on before we realized this. So, I mean, the safe way to do things is to kind of do what we did, is do not do the standard, if you're gonna do statistics, even with big data, sometimes you need to. Not to use, you know, what people call a parametric distribution. So maybe if people have done any basic stats, you might hear like normal distribution. And there you focus on, it basically predicts the distribution of events. And, you know, so the higher the vertical axis there, the more likely the event. And what you do is you look if something's aberrant, you know, so here if it's maybe in the top 5%, then you say, oh, that we've got something interesting here. But that relies on assumptions. And as we just saw, like sometimes our assumptions aren't exactly right. So instead you could do more of these permutation approaches where you build up a distribution by shuffling your data and basically using your data to form your own distribution. So obviously this is something, you know, there's probably tons of videos online that would spend an hour doing this. So I'm just gonna give a really brief flavor in case anyone wants to chase up on it. But so, you know, for our purposes in this explore-exploit, we had the original data, we analyzed it. We could also permute it. So here I'm just showing the same data from a shopper, but it's in a different order, you know? And so then we could analyze that the same way as the actual data. We could do this thousands of times and just like plot it out. And then we could, so we could get a distribution, what we call what would happen according to chance. And then we could see where in that distribution does our actual result fall. And it turns out it's very extreme. So, I mean, I guess there the lesson would be, you know, be really careful, you know, with sequential data. Any kind of analysis you do is going to involve assumptions. And so one way to get around those is do a permutation test where it's almost like what statistics should have been. It's just that we didn't have fast computers in the past. We didn't have the ability to do these things. And now
5% was a classic example of that. He just produced a set of tables. And I'm forgetting who he was. And you'll help correct me here, Brad. But you just had that, it computed this curve because we can't plot that normal distribution mathematically. We run numbers and then you have to kind of work these, how many standard deviations give you the 5%? And
yeah, exactly.
And should it have been 2% or 1%?
Yeah, I mean, luckily with these big data things, sometimes it's 0.01, but sometimes not, right? So if you have to do some kind of intervention like the coupon study, we only sent it to 5,000 people, so we're still in the realm of using statistics. But yeah, you're absolutely right. So before we used to have tables, but even if you knew the exact probabilities, you could compute them. You're still making so many assumptions about like how your data is structured when you use like what we call like parametric statistics. And it's almost like more like statistics for like more, you know, hackers or computer science people. Like there's no reason, you don't have to learn these distributions. You could just make them yourself, you know, using your data. And usually they tend to be more robust, you know, so there is actually, you don't get these catastrophic mistakes. So like, I do some work in brain imaging and try to relate this to modeling. And there's this big scandal in that area recently where one of the most popular stats packages for analyzing these data sets, and they're quite large, you know, they're like 100 gigabytes of images. And I mean, it was inflating the results. It was because it had an inappropriate assumption in it. And, you know, the solution there was just, again, just do a permutation test, use your data as its own distribution. So this is a general lesson, and then maybe an extra note of caution when you're working with sequential data, because a lot of your intuitions about sequences don't actually correspond to reality.
And so what you're doing here is you've just taken just shuffle the deck, essentially.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So instead of them all being in time order, each of those data points.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So for the few hundred thousand people, in black is the actual data, and then for each person, what we did is we just shuffled. So week one would be, you know, week 10, and week two would be week four. They're just all shuffled in a random permutation, random order. But then we just treated that data, that shuffled data, as if it were real data and analyzed it with the models. And so that's what's being plotted in gray there.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the key thing here visually is just these two distributions are different. Mm. If these distributions were really overlapping and the same, well, you'd be like, well, there's nothing really in my data. It's just some artifact of sequences of just how the data are structured. Yeah. I can't actually predict much. So here's one way to deal with, you know, am I actually picking up on something real in the data? We talked about another way earlier in terms of cross-validation. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you can do all these things, and of course, if you could collect your own sample of data to test it, even better, but that's costly and something, you know, if someone's coming to you with an application, you're not going to always have that option.
And it's likely going to be a very small sample, and then we're back into the fact that's going to be not a normal distribution.
Yeah, exactly.
Again.
So this is something that people could do, and it's going to take some learning, probably going through some tutorial, but it doesn't require, like, you know, as much background, because you're basically just computing it on the fly. You're doing it yourself. So in some ways, you'll need, like, less background knowledge to do this, too. Maybe just very briefly touch on another topic, sort of more of a creative use of, so maybe some of the listeners do work in search, or, you know, relating search terms to one another. So there's all this interest in that, and, like, here I'll just talk really briefly about adapting some of those techniques to people's retail purchase patterns. So you can imagine that you're doing this in online commerce. So, you know, what makes a cat like a dog? So cat and dogs, we interact with them in similar ways, right? You pet a cat, you pet a dog, you feed your dog, you feed your cat. You don't do these things with a moped. So it's one rationale, because cats and dogs appear in similar contexts. That makes them more similar. Of course, cats and dogs are not exactly the same thing. So you take dogs for a walk. I mean, these sort of slightly different contexts they appear in could help explain, like, why people see them as different. There's some theories of meaning that work that way. Of course, you know, there are exceptions. It's all probabilistic. So you can take a cat for a walk. Apparently, I saw one in Tottenham the other day. It
shocked me. Cat obedience classes.
Yeah, exactly. lots of luck. So this idea was actually formalized by a psychologist and computer scientist in terms of called latent semantic analysis. So basically, it was devised for words. So imagine you had a bunch of articles, like every article. I think they used the Wall Street Journal newspaper early on. And you have these terms like money or employee, whatever you have. So that would be going on the rows. And then you'd have different articles. So those would be the context, the documents. Yep. And you just tally up, how many times does this word appear in this document and this other document? And so if two terms were similar, two concepts were similar, you'd expect the rows to, you know, correlate with each other, the counts to be similar. And to make it work a little bit better, you use this low rank matrix approximation technique called an SVD, but it just basically helps it generalize a little bit better. And the newer version of this, there's no time to really get into the details, is latent Dirichlet allocation. It's a similar idea, but it's in a Bayesian terms. And there's all kinds of packages people could use to do this. But it says documents are generated by a mix of themes or topics. So imagine you had an article about a football player that was injured. So then you'd probably have themes of sport and medicine, you know, in there. Maybe even finances, right? If it's like, oh, we're going to bomb out of the Champions League now, and what's going to happen in the transfer window? So you could model these documents as a combination of these things, and it works fairly well. And so here, just really briefly, we're going to do a trick. We're going to use the same technique that's used, but instead of having words, we're going to have products in a supermarket, and instead of having documents as the context, we'll have baskets. So what did a person buy? And so we can analyze millions of baskets. So this, I think, actually did require some technology behind the scenes to just chomp through this. And just some preliminary results. So this actually works. So you pull out similarity spaces for products. So you get general topics like ready-made meals emerging, you know, things that you would when you want to pretend you're cooking but aren't really cooking, low-cost shop. But you also get very interesting specific topics that are incredibly specific. So you'll have a topic of just everything you would buy to make a stir fry. Or a really interesting one, it only occurs in late November to January 1st or so, which is Christmas buy, you know, like, you know, roast and stuff. Yeah.
In your stir fry example there, would you have, you know, maybe like a recipe book sort of that you'd want to mine for the same analysis, potentially? Or would you infer the recipe book from there?
Yeah, so what's really neat about this is the model, just like the techniques this has been applied to in computational linguistics, doesn't know anything about this. So like so it just has these product codes, and it doesn't even know that like a small Coke is similar to a larger Coke, you know? And it's pulling out these themes. But yeah, so you could, there's just emerging from the data. So this is kind of neat, because this is something that's been done in, with words, with computational linguistics, but you could imagine this for all kinds of things. You could imagine even applying it, we talked before about social networks, you imagine applying it to people in their interactions and figuring out, you know, what kinds of people are they, or what departments are they?
So, I mean, obviously, traditionally, we think this text analysis is doing things like aggregating news feeds and... you know, in your academic world, making sure that I haven't copied the homework from Johnny around the corner there because I don't know what I'm doing. And because the two articles are really, really similar and the same terms are appearing in the same sort of frequencies.
Yeah.
But this is what fascinates me about data science. You can take a technique, a well-established technique over here for text analysis, and suddenly we're applying it to a completely different area of human behavior.
Yeah. No, it's really exciting. Yeah, this didn't have to work, but yeah, I guess that's with the stress. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the listeners could think of applications where they could... you know, if they want to read up on these techniques, use them for things we would never even think of, you know? So it's basically anything where you have parts, like words or products that organize into some larger context or peer modelable context, like different newspaper articles or different shoppers' baskets. And I guess the miracle of, you know, having a decent model and tons of data, we could make this work. So, it's funny, we talked about overfitting before.
Yeah,
so really just quick note on this. So we used a popular commercial machine learning package to do this at first, and I'm not going to, like, call out names, but it completely did not work right. So so this is showing exactly what, Andrew, what you were talking about before, that as the model gets more complex, so that's showing model flexibility there on the horizontal axis, it'll fit the data better that you can see, but it'll overfit and it'll generalize poorly to new data that hasn't seen, so out of sample. And that's really what we care about, right? We don't want to understand what we have. We want to understand the future or things we haven't seen yet. So with the topics models, complexity corresponds to just, you know, how many topics are there? It's basically how many parameters are there to estimate in this model. And so as we increase the number of topics, we just saw weird things would happen in this package. This is just sort of having a general idea of how these models work, even if you're not expert in them. So the goodness of fit should go up, right? And eventually generalization should go down as you add more and more topics to overfit. That didn't happen here. There's other things, general things we picked up on this model too, that as it's learning and it's going through the training set and it iterates through, it does something called expectation maximization. But the details of it don't matter, but what matters is that it has to get better every iteration, and it wasn't. It's just sort of, like something was wrong, so we switched to a different package, and then, of course, it worked fine and with the results I showed. But I guess the point here is, even if everyone can't be a machine learning researcher, but you should just pick up on a couple basic properties or checks or characteristics, you know, warning signs that the model isn't doing right, and do those checks, because otherwise you could use a respected package, and for whatever reason, you know, there's some demons lurking in there, you'll end up getting results that, you know, you look at it, it'll look fine, but it's, you know, it's not. So if you just do a few couple quick checks, you could catch these things. Yeah.
So standing back from the theory of whether we're going to do text and analytics, or whether we're going to do logistic regression, whether we're going to do forecasting, is there a sort of a bluffer's guide to being a data scientist? Partly from coming to a Bradley Love lecture, that is. You know, in other words, this is the sorts of approaches and techniques that we should be doing, irrespective of what algorithm or the, you know, approach to the problem, if you will.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I mean, I need to give it more thought, and when I have a good answer, I'll put it on my Twitter to share it with folks. There's got to be partial solutions to this, but I guess what amazes me is just how often it doesn't happen, even with experts. So, like, you know, it's something that really needs to be done more, a little bit more care. I think this area is just moving so quickly that everyone's falling over themselves to get things done. And maybe, you know, we should just try to advocate here doing things a little bit more theory-driven, maybe working with simpler models, having, you know, results you can make sense of, and just some checks you could just kind of trust what you have and build off of it. And so I think there's all these amazing advances now, but yeah, it would be good. And I'll give it some thought and try to post some useful links. Yeah.
Title for your next book. Because I think the need is out there. We're seeing, whether it's us in data science and so on, mm-hmm. we need more rigor.
Yeah,
we need more science in our science, if you sort of
yeah, know. Yeah, and it's just not like because it's good for us or in some moral sense. I think it's what you actually need to make further progress in the future. Because right now everything is fairly wide open, but you know, as these systems become more important to our lives and we demand more and more of them, I mean, I think that's just the way things are going to go. It's probably a way people can distinguish themselves too by doing this, you know, higher quality work. Yep. So you can hopefully move up the value chain in your own area.
Bradley, thank you very much for taking an hour out of your busy day.
Yeah.
And really good talking to you. I've certainly learned a lot from that, and I think our audience have done too. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back in 15 minutes to talk about careers and what we should do about that.